a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I am glad you're with us on the program today. We're going to be talking with our friend Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. So they announced yesterday a new chapter, and they don't lie for the other guy, anti-straw purchasing campaign. What's interesting is, you know, this is a partnership that NSSF does with the ATF. And so one of the questions I had for Larry, and you'll hear his response, is has it become harder to actually work even professionally with this agency when you've got the head of the ATF demanding that Congress pass a quote-unquote assault ban, even though he won't define what guns he actually wants to prohibit you and I from owning and purchasing? Anyway, we'll get to that in just one moment. Before we do, Biden's America, it is crushing us. You've got companies laying off tens of thousands of workers, one after the other. Americans working two jobs just to get by. Inflation pushing hardworking families to the brink. Just look at the price of lunch meat next time you go to the grocery store. And a digital dollar could be coming down the pipeline to completely destroy our way of life. The truth is, you need a plan. You know it, and I know it. And that's why you should call GoldCo, so you can diversify your savings and investments with gold and silver before things get worse. They're a six-time Inc. 5000 winner, 2022 Company of the Year, thousands of five-star reviews, and they've helped people like you and me place over $1 billion in gold and silver. They're offering up to $10,000 in free silver while supplies last. And if you call them today, qualified callers will get a free Ronald Reagan half-ounce silver coin. So don't wait. Call GoldCo at 855-412-3806 today. That's 855-412-3806. So the conversation with Larry Keene from the NSSF is, I would say, somewhat wide ranging. We don't focus specifically on the Don't Lie for the Other Guy campaign, but or the strained relationship between the industry and or the agency now that you've got a committed gun control activist in charge. But that is the starting point of our conversation. Take a look and a listen. Larry, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It's good to see you, sir.
It's always a pleasure to spend time with you, Cam. Hope you're well.
I am doing all right, and I hope the same for you. So tell me about what's going on in Fort Worth. You guys launching the new Don't Lie for the Other Guy campaign?
Yeah, we do several launches a year in the Don't Lie program, which is, you know, we've been doing this in partnership with ATF, regardless of who's in the White House, what party controls the White House. We've been doing the Don't Lie for the Other Guy program, which actually started as a pilot program in 1999 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it's, you know, we've been doing it ever since, funded chiefly, almost exclusively by the industry. We've seen some small grants from DOJ way back, and there's some money in the budget coming up this fiscal year for the government that was put in there through the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. But so Don't Lie for the Other Guy is partnership between ATF and NSSF to try to address the issue of illegal straw purchases, which is one way criminals obtain a firearm, and certainly not the most prevalent way. In fact, it's a very small percentage, but you know, it's something that the industry can work on with ATF. So we did launch in the Fort Worth media market, and the campaign has sort of two components to it. One is to raise awareness among dealers on how to be better able to identify potential straw purchases and what to look for. And of course, if you encounter that, you know, to deny the sale and to contact ATF about that illegal or potentially illegal activity, which dealers do all the time and have always done. And, dealers are the number one source to ATF that leads to illegal trafficking investigations. And the other component of the program is to, public service announcement, if you will, to educate the would-be straw purchaser that it's a serious crime. It's a felony. Now you can get up to 15 years and $250,000 fine. And now there is actually a specific standalone crime of illegal straw purchasing that was enacted by Congress. Even though it's always been illegal, now it has its own code section in the Gun Control Act. So we go in and buy up media in the market to get the message out, and last for a number of months. And It's very well received by the dealer community. And we work with local ATF offices, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and frequently local law enforcement attends the event. We often do them actually in a dealership, because the dealers are on the front lines. They're an ally in trying to stop illegal straw purchasing, which is where somebody who's in lies on the 4473 says they're the actual buyer when they're actually not. They're acting as an agent or a straw purchaser for somebody else. Frequently, it's a prohibited person who can't pass a background check, or it's a trafficker that doesn't, want their name associated with the transaction. So we're very proud of the program. It shows that the industry is part of the solution. We are not the quote-unquote enemy, as the president likes to say. It's very unfortunate rhetoric coming from the White House. So we're very proud of that program, and we put an emphasis on it, and we'll continue to do it. We did one in Georgia a little while ago. I think we have one coming up in January, probably around the SHOT Show in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Where we do them is decided by ATF. They determine where it's most beneficial. They have access to that, law enforcement sensitive information about where there might be an issue. So I've always let ATF decide. It's, we don't know. We don't have that information. So,
yeah. You say that this program obviously is done no matter who's in the White House. But, you did bring up Joe Biden declaring that the firearms industry is the enemy. We even had Steve Dettelbach recently at Harvard come out and say, yeah, you know what? We do need a gun ban. We do need an assault weapons ban. I can't define it. Don't ask me to define it. It's up to Congress to define what guns should be banned. But, yeah, we should definitely ban some guns. Which is, that's not what Steve Dettelbach was talking about when he was confirmed. He was taking a much more hands-off approach. So I have to ask, how hard is it to partner with the ATF when you have an administration that's declared the industry to be the enemy, when you have an ATF director who said, yeah, we need more gun control laws? Does it become more difficult to extend that hand and say, all right, listen, let's work together to try to stop people from illegally obtaining firearms?
It certainly does, and you're absolutely correct. That's not what Director Dettelbach said during his confirmation hearing. Now, all of a sudden, he's calling for bans on, modern sporting rifles. He's calling for universal background checks. These are things he personally believes. He campaigned on these issues when he ran unsuccessfully in Ohio to be the attorney general. But I will tell you, Cam, I've been around for a long time and have worked with ATF directors going all the way back to 2000. And I can never recall a director taking a position and calling for legislation, whether they believe it personally or not. That was not their job. Dettelbach said in his hearing, it's up to Congress to pass the laws. We will enforce the laws you pass. But for a director to take a position on legislation publicly was really concerning. It's unprecedented, and we think it's a terrible mistake. So yeah, it does become more difficult to engage with ATF. But our view at NSSF is the worm will turn, right? He will not always be the director, and the parties change and who's in control. To us, it's important that, we as the trade association for the industry have to have a dialogue with the regulator to represent the interests of our members and of the industry. That does not mean we agree with their positions. Obviously, we very aggressively disagree with the calls to ban commonly owned modern sporting rifles and other, or any firearm for that matter. Or for universal background checks, because we know that leads to and only works if there's national registration. So, but we can disagree in a professional manner, and that's what we try to do. So the fact that we work with ATF on this program on Operation Secure Store, it's because it's in the interest of the industry that we do this in public safety. So, it is frustrating and disconcerting when you have a director expressing policy preferences, calling for legislation. That's not his job. And I wouldn't be surprised, and I think I expect to see the Democrats in the Senate and in that to introduce legislation in the wake of the tragedy in Lewiston, as we saw again, immediately calling for bans on rifles, as if that somehow is going to solve the problem, or if that somehow was what was responsible for what happened in Lewiston. We know what occurred, or actually more accurately, didn't occur in Lewiston. All of the signs were there. People were calling law enforcement, seeking help. The balls were dropped by the police in New York, the police and law enforcement in Maine, by the Army. You know, was he a prohibited person or not? If he was, why wasn't it reported to Nix? If he wasn't, why wasn't he? Why was he not arrested when he made threats to the base in Maine? Why was he not in custody? Maine has a yellow flag law, which, of course, the gun control groups think is inadequate. But I actually think had that law been enforced and used the way it's intended, and there was, by the way, a surge in the use of yellow flags in Maine in 23. There was an article about that in the Bangor paper just before he purchased the firearms in July. And interestingly, as you may know, but maybe for the benefit of your audience, the dealer in Maine, when he went to pick up the suppressor, so obviously he had passed the NFA background check by ATF, which is nothing more, by the way, than a NICS check. They just check the same databases. The check is done by the FBI when the ATF sends the Form 4 over. When he showed up at that dealer's in July, I believe it was, and he filled out the 4473, he checked that he was a prohibited person. He had been voluntarily committed or to a mental institution, or and the question also asks, are you adjudicated a mental defective? That's the term in the statute.
Right.
And he checked, yes, the dealer refused to transfer the suppressor to that individual. So they did their job. Whether he should have been in mix as a prohibited person, NSSF led the effort the past over 10 years on the Fix Mix campaign to require the states to get these records, chiefly disqualifying mental health records, into the background check system, because dealers rely upon the accuracy. They don't know. They have to rely upon the information in the database. And it's only as good as the information that's put in. Many states don't put those records in or didn't put those records in because of privacy concerns, privacy laws. We got those laws changed in 16, 17 states and significantly increased the records that go into the background check system. Then Sutherland Springs happened. We learned that the military, not just the Air Force, all uniformed branches and other federal law enforcement agencies, as it turns out, were not putting those records in. And that led to the Fix Nix Act, which was named after our program to try to address that. Nobody wants dangerously mentally ill people like this individual getting firearms. He should have been, received the treatment he needed. When he threatened the base, he should have been arrested. This event should not have happened if the law had been followed. It's very disappointing to hear politicians, including Congressman Golden, who's voted against these bans, because he's told us, to me personally, that he doesn't vote that way for politics. He votes that way because he believes it. Well, now he's singing a different tune, and it's unfortunate and it's disappointing. And again, banning these firearms is not going to solve the problem. As you know, they're very rarely used to commit murders in the United States in general. Obviously, when they occur in these high-profile situations, it garners a lot of media attention. But it's not going to solve the problem. We have bigger issues in this country. Our mental health system is broken. It doesn't work. People are not getting the care they need. And that leads to these types of situations, which are preventable and should not have, had he been reported as, and had the police done their job under the yellow flag law, this would not have happened.
I'm with you. I mean, I think even, you know, you could take the yellow flag law, I think, out of the equation and just talk about the civil commitment law. I mean, because it sounds like the Boston Globe reported that he was involuntarily committed to that Army facility in New York. So that should have, as you say, triggered a prohibition on a NICS check. And as you say, you know, we know that that didn't happen in Sutherland Springs, where the Air Force didn't report a crime that was a disqualifier. Senator Angus King and Senator Susan Collins have been asking questions of the Army Inspector General, hoping to get to the bottom of this. But once he got out and returned home, as you say, his family, law enforcement, all of these entities were aware of his deteriorating mental condition. And now, if he had been involuntarily committed in July and his family was concerned that he was getting worse in August, then again, why were those steps not taken to try to get him committed in Maine, or at least to get before a mental health professional? That is the first step in a yellow flag law. And I think you're right. Those questions we don't have answers to. But the idea that we can just ban our way to safety, it's just absurd to me. I mean, Larry, I grew up in Oklahoma City. One of the first big news stories I was aware of as a kid was the Edmond Post Office shootings. You know, and this was a horrible tragedy that involved the use of two handguns. You know, I was living in Virginia when Virginia Tech occurred. And again, the killer there used two handguns. The idea that, well, if we just ban these guns over here, we're all going to be safe. It may be a comforting fiction to some people, but it is still a fiction. As you say, we have got to address, I think, mental health concerns, but we also, again, have to make sure that our criminal justice system is functioning as effectively as it can. We have to make sure that the juvenile justice system is functioning. I mean, you look at what's going on in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, Chicago, where you've got, you know, teens who are being arrested 6-7 times, charged with violent crimes, and they're put right back out on the street. You know, we are failing to address the crumbling institutions that we have set up specifically to fight violent crime, specifically to stop these types of things. And instead, we just, well, let's just pass a law and everything will be better. If I wasn't a Second Amendment advocate, it would infuriate me because it is such a, I want to be a player, but it's a baloney solution. It is a nonsensical solution to a very serious problem.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this issue on mental health goes all the way back to really kind of the 70s. Mm-hmm. This trend of deinstitutionalizing the mentally ill. They were put out on the street. Their families couldn't take care of these people. They went off their meds. You had paranoid schizophrenics living on the streets of major cities. That was really, you know, the cause of homelessness is not typically and rarely that somebody, you know, doesn't have the economic means to pay rent. There's a social safety network in place. It is chiefly people who are mentally ill or are substance abusers. And so that's really the root cause. And that, you know, but it started with the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill and the lack of care. And if you look at almost all of these high profile tragedies, you know, you will find almost always the root cause is mental health. It's not the control or the failure of gun control. It is the failure of our mental health system writ large in this country. I mean, Tucson, Aurora, Sandy Hook. I mean, the list goes on and on, sadly.
Yeah.
And you know, you see things, you see efforts by Congress periodically, the Fix NICS Act, the NICS Improvement Act, some of the titles of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. It sought to provide more resources for mental health at the community level. You know, you see states passing so-called red flag laws. Maine has what they call a yellow flag. I actually like the idea that it has to go through law enforcement, you know, because that reduces the risk that, you know, these laws will be, red flag laws will be abused in, you know, child custody disputes, divorces, and things like that. You know, it goes through the police. They get to investigate and can go to court and say, okay, this person, here's the reason, judge, something needs to be done. And there are, you know, even aside from that, as you mentioned, there are civil commitment laws on the books, I think, in every state.
Every state, yeah.
That address this, that when somebody's having a mental health crisis, as was this individual. So we're glad to hear that the governor in Maine has called for an independent investigation. I think it would be appropriate for Congress to conduct some oversight hearings about what happened. I'm not sure they'll do that or not. But, you know, and I think as the facts have been coming out, as you mentioned, the Boston Globe article, the CNN articles, you know, it seems to me that the call for banning rifles has subsided somewhat. You know, it's not, this is not the poster child for the gun control community, right? I mean, and they can talk all they want about, well, if only we had a red flag law. You know, the laws were there, and as is so often the case, you know, it's the laws that were not enforced, right? I mean, going back to our discussion on straw purchasing. Okay, so now there's a crime on the books for illegal firearms trafficking, which was already illegal. Now there's a separate specific crime for that. There's now a separate specific crime for straw purchasing. Where's the data that shows those laws are being enforced? Because what I'm hearing is they're not being enforced by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are again, every election cycle, you know, when you start to, we need these laws. And then when you look, they're not used. They're not enforced. They're not prosecuted. So I think Congress needs to take a look at that. I think the media, if they're honest, should take a look at that. What good is it to pass all laws if they're not going to be enforced? And I think the public understands that, you know, because these politicians like to get up, hold press conferences, issue press releases, and say, look at me, look what I did. I passed a law, and then nothing happens.
Right.
That's a yellow flag law. Nothing happens. I mean, look at Parkland. You know, the laws were in place to address that individual in Parkland long before, you know, a red flag law was passed. Connecticut had a similar law. Indiana had a similar law long before, you know, Sandy Hook occurred. Wasn't used. So, again, it does it no good to pass laws that are, you know, feel good but ineffective in terms of actually addressing the issue. So,
yeah,
it's frustrating, but, you know, people need to pay attention. You know, Second Amendment advocates like your audience, you know, need to engage politically. That obviously includes registering to vote, showing up at the polls and casting their vote, and, you know, going to town halls, going to city hall meetings, writing their legislators, expressing their views. Don't allow the anti-gun to be the only voices in the room. Don't allow the media to muzzle Second Amendment supporters.
Absolutely.
Pun intended.
You're absolutely right, Larry. Listen, we're running a little long here. So I tell you what, next time we have you on, let's talk more about voter activism, Second Amendment activism, as we head into the 2024 election cycle. Because I there is that new political action committee. I want to talk a little bit more about that. But thank you again for joining me today, man. I always appreciate the conversation. You know, I hate sometimes the topics that we're discussing, but I think it is very important to get this information out there. So thanks again for being on the show today.
It's always a pleasure, buddy. Good to see you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Larry Keene joins us from the National Shooting Sports Foundation here on Cam & Company. My thanks to Larry for joining us on the program, and looking forward to having him back again very soon to talk about the 2024 election cycle. Now that we've put 2023 behind us, not a great night in the state of Virginia. I got to tell you, the GOP has 2 years to figure this out, or else we are going to be staring down the barrel of a semi-auto ban here in the Old Dominion. Every seat, well, state Senate in control of Democratic hands, and that'll be the case 2 years from now. In 2025, Glenn Youngkin is term limited out. You'll have, two new candidates to choose from. Every seat in the House of Delegates is going to be up for grabs. Republicans are going to have to capture either the governor's mansion or, retake the House of Delegates in order to have any shot whatsoever of beating back what is sure to be an onslaught of gun control legislation. So, yeah, we'll be talking with Larry Keene about the 2024 and maybe even the 2025 elections coming up here in the very near future. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there. St. Cloud, Minnesota. A man arrested in a shooting at a St. Cloud party that killed one and injured two others. Well, known to law enforcement already, as a matter of fact, according to KSTP TV in the Twin Cities, 26-year-old Delonte Juwan Parker, accused of fatally shooting 34-year-old Antonio Carl Harris Jr. and injuring two others at a party back on October 22nd. Police responded to an area in the 700 block of 6th Avenue South after getting reports of shots fired. There they found multiple people in and around a residence, according to a news release. Investigators say it was a dispute that led to the shooting that critically injured Antonio Harris, who passed away at the scene despite life-saving efforts. Two others, a 52-year-old man and a 26-year-old man, taken to the hospital for non-life-threatening gunshot wounds. Parker was initially arrested on October 27th on an unrelated probation violation, and then police were able to connect him to the shooting while he was in custody. He has now been charged with second-degree murder, felon in possession of a firearm, and second-degree assault with a dangerous weapon. He's being held in custody on suspicion of these charges, but no formal charges have yet been filed. According to KSTP, court records show that Parker has several past felony convictions, including assault with a dangerous weapon and other weapon and drug offenses, again, at the not-too-ripe old age of 26 years old. Multiple felony convictions. They're talking about, you know, all kinds of new restrictions on lawful gun owners in Minnesota. We talked with Brian Strausser of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus about this not long ago. Meanwhile, you've got individuals who are not legally eligible to purchase a firearm at all with multiple felonies to their name before the age of 30. Maybe, just maybe, lawmakers should talk more about the consequences for violent criminals rather than infringing on the rights of legal gun owners. My suspicion. Today's armed citizen story from the Bay Area of California, where a homeowner shot and killed a suspected intruder on Monday, according to police. Even in the Bay Area, you are starting to see more signs that people are taking the right to keep their arms seriously. This was in Vallejo, California. The alleged burglar broke through a glass front door of a home around 9:45 in the morning. The homeowner was there and shot the suspect in what the Vallejo Police Department is calling what appears to be self-defense. According to the East Bay Times, the Detective Division of the Vallejo Police Department took command of the investigation. They were carrying black trash bags out of the residence Monday evening while an officer spoke to an individual. A board covered a large hole in the front door of the home Tuesday morning. Nobody answered the door when the East Bay Times went and tried to ask the homeowner some questions. But again, at this point, it would appear to be a lawful use of force here. You've got a burglar breaking into your home, and police, again, are describing this as a quote, apparent act of self-defense. Finally, today, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a police officer in Lincoln, Nebraska, who jumped into a frigid lake to save a woman who is screaming for help after her kayak capsized. Here is a screen grab of the officer as he emerged from the lake. There were several 911 calls that came in saying that a woman was drowning and screaming for help at a lake. This was November the 6th. Officer Pierce Krause arrived on scene, spotted the woman about 25 to 30 yards from the shore at Holmes Lake. He stripped off his duty gear, went into the water, rescued her, brought her and the kayak back to shore. Krause told KLKN, says the whole point of the job is just to help people as much as possible. He said, I don't think I could have stood there on the shore and waited for the rescue team to get here, knowing that she had been in there so long. The woman was uninjured. Krause checked out of the hospital before he was back in a dry uniform and returning to the rest of his shift. I guess he got a chance to go home, take a shower, and then went back on patrol, according to the Lincoln Police Department. Krause said it was just a relief when she got there. She was a little bit shaken up, understandably, but thankfully she was okay. So again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need. Might have just been another day on the job for Pierce Krause, but still deserving of a tip of the hat, and we thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow, right here, for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day, where we are keeping you abreast of all of the latest developments when it comes to your right to keep and bear arms from Supreme Court oral arguments. But we don't have any of those today, thankfully. But you never know when we're going to get another court decision. Legislation starting to be filed around the country. Armed citizen stories and more. Again, you can find it all at BaryonArms.com. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just go to BaryonArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code GUNRIGHTS, and you can get a significant savings on your VIP membership. Special shout out to my friend Val Trojan, who was listening the other day. Val, thank you so much. Looking forward to seeing you and your hubby before long. Looking forward to seeing you again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.